This week, mothers take center stage.
Mom, do you have any idea how profoundly different our dinner table conversation is than anyone else's?
What we learn from our mothers and making traditions work in a new era. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51% The Women's Perspective. Mother's Day is coming up, so this week, it's all about mom. We learn a lot from our mothers, more sometimes than they intend. Our families are reflections of our parents' interests, and that can lead to career choices once we've grown. Phoebe Judge features a mother and daughter who share an unusual interest. It's part of a series called This is Criminal.
There was a gentleman who had been living there for quite some time, and had been without heat since the previous November, and that was actually around the last time that he'd been seen alive.
This is Kathleen Vernon. She's the coroner for Albany County in southeastern Wyoming. In 2012, she was called to a small cabin out on the prairie, not far from Laramie, where she lives.
And one of his family members had finally called in to the sheriff's department to go check on him. And they had found that he was no longer living.
It was January and 32 degrees inside the cabin. What they found was basically a mummified body. When Kathleen got the body back to the lab and began the autopsy, things got even more bizarre. It looked like the man had been getting hypothermia and then somehow surviving it over and over again. Which seemed crazy, like something out of a movie, until Kathleen remembered seeing something unusual in his house.
In the refrigerator of his home, there had been a bottle of antifreeze next to a drinking glass. You know, it's kind of a weird place to keep antifreeze. I don't generally keep things like that in the fridge. And as it turned out, he had ethylene glycol crystals in his kidneys, which is what happens when you consume antifreeze. The active ingredient is ethylene glycol. So the theory that we came up with was that he had been intentionally consuming antifreeze to keep himself from freezing, from dying of hypothermia, and that for at least a while it had probably worked.
What did you do when you figured this out?
So I called my mom.
Kathleen, do you remember the call when you said, I'm going to call my mom, and the police officers around you laughed, and one of them said,
yeah.
You don't know her mom?
Yeah, one of the officers was like, oh, well, it makes sense. Her mom's an investigator, too.
It was also 3 o'clock in the morning.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's when this happens.
There are only 3 female coroners in the entire state of Wyoming. Kathleen Vernon, or Casey, as her family calls her, is one of them. She's 25 years old and has been working with the coroner's office since she was 21, her first job out of college, which, it goes without saying, isn't exactly something you learn about at a career fair. So you can't help but wonder, how did she get to this point?
We perhaps exposed Kathleen to life situations that 99% of people never see or hear about.
This is Linda Vernon, Kathleen's mom. Linda spent decades as a homicide investigator and coroner in California. Kathleen's father, Bill, is an investigator for the state of Wyoming. Growing up in Cheyenne, the Vernon family surrounded themselves with other people in law enforcement. It's a pretty small town. And when the Vernons had a party, most of the talk was about cases people were working on, bad guys they had just caught. So when Kathleen started showing an interest in death, something that would scare a lot of parents, the Vernons took it in stride. Like one time when Kathleen was about 4 years old and found a dead gopher in the backyard. She spent a weekend crouched over its body, watching flesh-eating beetles take it apart.
I've always really liked bugs. Like, I really like bugs. and I think they were red or orange and just the coolest things that I'd ever seen.
And then, when she was 11, Kathleen took it a step further and began raising beetles for a science fair project. Linda was all for it.
You know, in museums, they usually have tanks of beetles that they can debride flesh from bones with and end up with perfect specimens for display or study. And she said, I want to do that. So I called the Museum of Natural History in Denver and got a hold of the curator. And he kindly sent her a box of beetles from his tank. And so for many weeks, we had a 20-gallon aquarium in our living room full of bugs and dead things.
And you would you all just sit around watching it kind of on the couch like it was a television?
No. but she had to keep track of what they were doing and watch very carefully, because one of the specimens that she put in there was a bird, and they have very tiny bones, and these bugs will completely consume the tiny bones on a small specimen like that. And we also did not kill anything for her to do this. A bird flew into our living room window as happenstance, karmic happenstance, I think. And so she collected that and put it in there first. And then we contacted a local taxidermist, and he was kind enough to give us a skull. I believe it was a fox skull, Casey?
It was a fox.
And then we tried, that Thanksgiving, we tried a turkey neck. But it was cooked, and the beetles apparently don't care for their specimens to be cooked. They didn't do as good a job on that as they did on her other things.
After the science project ended, Kathleen, 11 years old, made a special box to preserve that little bird carcass. And even today, the bird skeleton lies in its box in her mother's sewing room. When Linda gave birth to Kathleen, she stopped working as a homicide investigator and coroner. But she couldn't actually give up the work she loved so much. So she began writing for police trade publications like Police Magazine and Police Chief Magazine. Once, Linda was writing about blood spatter and recreated a crime scene in the house with real blood, her own blood.
I went to visit our family doctor. I explained what I was doing and asked him if he would draw a vial of my blood for me to use, because I certainly wouldn't have wanted to use an unknown specimen of blood, for example. And you get best results with the real thing. So my blood was the best way to do this. So he drew me a vial of blood, and I set up a crime scene in the back hall of our house and did the blood spatters and one-to-one photographs while Casey was gone from home. And when she came home, I think everything was pretty much gone.
And what did you say to her? What did you say to Kathleen when she was a little kid? How did you explain to her that there are people who do bad things sometimes and they can result in terrible injury or in death?
Pretty much exactly that way. My husband and I both strongly believe that if a child is intelligent enough to formulate a question, they deserve a truthful answer. And that is what she always got. Life is often not very pretty, but by the same token, it is often extraordinarily beautiful, and we tried to impart both those things to her.
Eventually, Kathleen moved out. She went to college. But unlike a lot of kids, Kathleen didn't leave her childhood interests at home. When she was in school, she called up the county coroner and told him she wasn't afraid of gruesome things. She said, "I'm not afraid of death, and I'd like to go out on a call with you."
I had just turned 21. It was like 6 days after my 21st birthday. And he called me. I was at a concert in town. He said, you know, we have a call. Do you want to go? And of course I think I knocked my chair over getting up to leave.
That night, she saw her first dead body. The coroner gave her a camera and told her to take photographs of the scene. It was a man who died of a stomach bleed.
And I thought it was just the most fascinating thing I'd ever seen, because I realized that you could piece together what this person's life had been like from the things that were in his house, from you know, his life on, in a holistic sense, what day-to-day life was like, down to what was that last night like.
After that first body, she was hooked. Now she works for the county. The coroner is an elected position, and she's serving her first term, about to run for re-election. Kathleen says she gets about 80 bodies a year. But the weird thing is that the work isn't steady. She'll have multiple bodies in the same day, and then nothing for a month.
It turns out that people die in groups. And I know that there are smarter people than I who've tried to figure out why this happens. I think the old wives' tale is that it's the moon. And there may be some truth to that, or it could be complete hocus pocus. You know, maybe it's the barometric pressure or the tides or who knows what. But that seems, there seems to be some sort of grouping that happens.
She says a lot of people in her field don't talk about their work with outsiders. It's just too sad, too morbid and depressing. So Kathleen feels lucky she can turn to her mother for support. And while Linda's tough, there have been cases that even she can't shake off.
One in particular was the only child of a farm labor family, and the father was gone. It was Christmas morning. The baby was 3 months old, and it was probably the hardest day to have to be there with that woman until I could find someone who could come and be an advocate for her. That was a very tough day. I was directly involved in the investigation of the homicide of two FBI agents, and I remember that day very vividly. I was on scene when two El Centro police officers were murdered in the line of duty. I remember that day. But you keep those things, like I explained to Casey, you keep those things in little boxes, and you shove them down as far as you can, and every once in a while you take them out and look. And I think it keeps you honest.
Kathleen, your husband is also a coroner, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, so basically everyone you're surrounded by is in some way involved with law enforcement or death. I wonder, what do you talk about at Thanksgiving?
If I can interject.
Yeah,
Casey
please.
Came home when she was a teenager and looked at me after having spent a weekend with a friend, I think, and said, "Mom, do you have any idea how profoundly different our dinner table conversation is than anyone else's?" it's an abiding thing. I mean, it's something we've talked about all of her life, and the cycle continues, apparently.
So much of what you do as a parent has an effect on your kid. And when so much of the family is in the business of death, well, your kid becomes a coroner and then gets married to another coroner. It's a little unclear how Kathleen feels about being so exposed to crime and death as a kid.
You know, I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with the way that I was raised or with how I turned out. I mean, I have a career. I'm, you know, relatively well adjusted for a person of my age and so forth. Whatever you do when you're a parent is going to have some kind of impact on your child. And at some point in that child's life, they're probably going to think that the impact is negative. All you can do is do the best you can.
So the big question now is, how much will Kathleen expose her own child? And it's not hypothetical. She's 8.5 months pregnant. Criminal is produced by Eric Mennel, Lauren Sporer, and me. Julianne Alexander does our cover art. Special thanks to Becky Martinez. If you like the show, you can subscribe on iTunes. You can get in touch with us at thisiscriminal.org or on Twitter at Criminal Show. I'm Phoebe Judge, and this is Criminal.
Coming up, a quiet revolution in a remote place, and mothers helping connect their children and grandchildren to traditions they've left behind. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1294. Papua, Indonesia's easternmost province, is one of the most remote and least developed corners on the planet. It's a hotspot for separatist fighters and a place where tribal culture is strong, including the domination of women by men. As a result, attempts to develop this part of the world have faltered, or at least until now. A unique development project, supported by the International Fund for Agricultural Development, appears to be making a difference, particularly for women. Joanne Levitan reports for UN Radio.
Magda Wetapo is growing vegetables. Tribal customs are strong here, and for women like Magda, this means they have no say over their lives, their families, and their futures. Men decide how women should think, live, and act.
If we try to violate these traditional practices, something bad would happen to us, like we would get sick. So we accepted it.
But then a small pilot project, initiated by the UN agency IFAD and the government of Indonesia, helped the women of this village gain a small amount of financial independence, which radically changed their lives. The project idea is simple. Facilitators work with community leaders to define their own problems and come up with their own solutions. The men finally agreed, after 3 months of discussions, that the women could receive training in agriculture and financial management. And now, after 2 years, the women have their own bank account for the first time. They decide for themselves how to use the money and how to farm. Magda is now empowered.
Before the project, men made the decisions about agriculture and when to plant the crops. But now we're working as a women's group and we need to make the plans and decide how the group will work. So now we make our own decisions.
The secret of the project's success, says IFAD's Ron Hartman, who worked with the government to develop it, is that it focuses on local needs rather than importing solutions from outside the region.
That report by Joanne Levitan comes to us from UN Radio. Culture helps define us and connect us to our family. But how do you pass on the culture of a country you can't remember? 3 generations of the Hong family in Portland, Maine, try to reconcile memories of Cambodia and genocide with a new American identity. Erica Lance reports.
Stella and Miles Hong are sitting on the floor of their grandmother's living room. They're the only Cambodian kids in their neighborhood, so their dad, Moni, brings them here to connect to their roots.
To say goodbye. What do you say goodbye?
But Stella and Miles don't know the whole story. They're too young to understand that their dad came here to escape a genocide that killed 2 million people.
Sometimes my kids are kind of confused that we're from Cambodia. Like, what do you mean you're from Cambodia? We live here. We haven't really gone into the whole, like, the war and how it all happened yet.
What makes it complicated is Moni can't remember Cambodia. He's a refugee who doesn't know the place he took refuge from, so it's not easy to pass on his culture. As a kid, Moni didn't fit in, but he had to piece together why. He had to learn about his past from his mom. Everybody. Sophie Hong runs a salon in the side room of her house on Hersey Street. She was a successful midwife in Phnom Penh before the Khmer Rouge displaced her. She helped pregnant women in the work camp, but the mothers had no food or blankets. Of the babies Sophie delivered, all but one died within a few hours or weeks.
How did you deal with that every time you deliver a baby to know that it's not going to survive? What did that feel like to you?
They kill everybody, and better let it go than what they live for, you know. Because like everybody living in the Khmer Rouge, they just don't want to live. They just want to go.
You're saying better that the babies died.
Better they die.
Sophie kept her own son alive by feeding him her rice rations. Finally, she fled. They escaped to Thailand and then the U.S., and Moni went to kindergarten. While Moni struggled at school, Sophie faced her own anxiety. She remembered friends being shot in front of her, or the night her mother died of starvation on the floor of their bamboo shack.
Sometimes at night, when you cannot sleep, you cannot forget like a picture in your brain. It doesn't matter how long I live here, I still dream about home.
But for Moni, those were stories, not memories.
I don't recall any of the, you know, the deaths, the killing. I remember us escaping at night. You know, we would walk forever, ever. And then I remember us just ducking and hearing bullets.
And that's about all he knows of his native country. Moni grew up an American. Sophia told him her second husband was his father. But then, when Moni was in middle school, Sophie sat with him at the kitchen table and told him his father had been killed by the Khmer Rouge.
But we never knew how he died. I never met him, never saw him. No pictures, no memories, nothing. So that part, growing up, sucked. Because you're starting to kind of have your own identity as a teenager. And then you start questioning, like, well, where did I come from? You know, where are these traits from?
Moni took comfort in finding Cambodian friends. They all shared the same history of trauma. They didn't talk about what happened to their parents. They just hang out and shoot bottle rockets at cop cars.
Kennedy Park, it was a rough neighborhood. A lot of kids got in trouble. The percentage of kids graduating from high school was very little. I think sports saved me.
He married a blonde Irish American named Stacy.
We had a traditional American wedding, and then we had a Buddhist wedding. We had a parade down the street, you know, like banging music and stuff. So if you don't understand the culture, you're like, what the hell is happening on Hershey Street?
Every Saturday, Moni takes 5-year-old Stella to Cambodian dance class. Today, she's learning to unfurl her fingers in the shape of blooming flowers.
Turn.
It's one way for Moni to show her the beautiful side of Cambodia, a side he never knew.
Good. Good job.
Stella has led Moni to think differently about his past. A few years ago, when she was 11 months old, Stella was diagnosed with leukemia.
Every emotion that you could feel went into my soul and I became numb. You start blaming yourself. Like, was it because I was in the war? Did I bring in something? It's sickening. You kind of find strength in everything. A lot of it, you know, was thinking like, you know, if my mom could do this and then get here from all that, I can do this.
These days, Stella's cancer-free and she barely remembers being sick. Moni will have to teach her about that past, too. For now, she and her brother learn about Cambodia from their grandma.
Because I don't have any fond memories of the country. Okay. I think it's important to hear from her directly than from me reading Google.
After dinner, Sophie pulls out a jigsaw puzzle for her granddaughter, and Stella pushes the cardboard pieces around the floor, trying different ones. It's one of those I spy pictures, a photograph of a hodgepodge of trinkets, plastic birds or cars, marbles, a compass. It takes her a while, and a few times, she almost gives up. But eventually, Stella fits the pieces together. For Salt Radio, I'm Erica Lance.
That report comes to us courtesy of the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. This week's show is number 1294. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.